We're deep diving that Falcons Super Bowl collapse, how much blame goes to Kyle Shanahan, how about Matt Ryan? We'll figure it all out. Also, the Falcons' surprise hire as their new offensive coordinator, the Packers release a couple of familiar names and old favorites, and Jay Cutler the Jet? We'll have all that and more on the MMQB 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast, possibly our last for a little while. We're going to podcast. We'll do the regular show that comes out on Monday. But as for the midweek show, we'll take a little time out here and we'll pick it up probably around free agency. We'll do a couple extra shows. But I'm Gary Gramling, and I'm here with Andy Benoit. We're the same two guys who are here all season. Andy, we're still going to be talking some Super Bowl here. Is that all right with you?
Yeah, it's fine with me. I spent the day watching the coaches' film. It's fresh on my mind. It was a good game the second time through just as much as it was the first time through.
All right. Well, we talked about this on Monday, obviously. We did a full deep dive on the game, coming right off of it. We were a little more, and I'll say we, but I want to say you, because I want to put this on you, a little kinder, a little lighter touch on Kyle Shanahan and Matt Ryan than the general public was. And I want to focus in on two plays here. And we got quite a few questions. We'll get to the mailbag later in the show. A couple people had written about this, specifically Gerard from Singapore on Facebook, Jackson Brown on Twitter. They want to know Kyle Shanahan's play calling. People are just having a tough time getting over this.
Well, people don't know what they're talking about, to be honest. And was every play call great? No, of course not. He dominated New England play calling wise in the first half, though, and really up through most of the third quarter. And then they had the issue in the two plays we're going to talk about. They were both critical sack plays, and that's people have taken that and ran with that, and they've labeled all of Kyle Shanahan's play calling with those two brush strokes, and that's wrong. That's short-sighted and foolish, and overlooking a guy who was the best, without question, the best play caller in the NFL throughout the regular season and continued to be that throughout the postseason, and that included in this game. He was very good. He was up to his usual level overall.
Well, let's start with the one. This is the only one that I really question, and I completely recognize there were play calls. Everyone said, you're too aggressive. Well, the aggressiveness, and we talked about this on Monday, the aggressiveness led to the Dante Freeman 39-yard catch and run. It led to the Julio Jones all-world catch that was a 28-yard gain. That's what aggressiveness also got them. I'm getting so upset about this. I'm just tripping over my words. But the one play call I had a problem with was the third and one, and this was the one that ended in the Dante Hightower strip sack.
Mm-hmm. Well, a few things on that. First of all, the people who have a problem with it, there's even more for your case than what's been made, because a lot of people are saying that's a five-step timing drop. How can you do that on third and one? It was five-step out of shotgun, which means it's actually seven-step drop timing, and they were slower developing routes. Take that for the anti-Shanahan play call side, but the pro side of it says it's not a bad call. Devontae Freeman blew an easy protection assignment. He just had a total mental breakdown. It happens once in a while, and it was costly there. And so Ryan was not expecting the pressure because there was no reason at all for the QB to think pressure would get there, because there was nothing complex about the front. It was obvious who was blocking who. One guy just forgot to do it. And then the other part was that there was a deep sail route, and Greg Cosell at NFL Films pointed this out to me. I had to go back and watch the film again, but they had Robinson from the inside slot, Aldrick Robinson, who did not play a lot at wide receiver for them in this game, inside slot on a deep sail route, which is kind of like a go route, but you're drifting a little bit towards the sideline. Yeah. He had a step on Malcolm Butler. He was wide open over the top, and Greg believes that's where Ryan was going with the ball. I tend to believe him. I'd have to look at that 10,000 times to know for sure, but the point is the play design had a chance to yield a really big gain. If you throw a big 50-yard completion to Aldrick Robinson late in the fourth quarter like that, or mid-fourth quarter, right when they were starting to come back on you, everyone's touting Kyle Shanahan for stomping on the throat, for putting the gas to the floor, for staying with it, staying aggressive. But it didn't work. But Kyle Shanahan doesn't know Devontae Freeman's going to have a mental breakdown in pass protection when he makes that call. So you can't analyze calls off of only the results. You have to look at what went into the call and did the design work. And the design did work. The execution broke down. Shanahan's not responsible for that kind of the execution.
And they had used that protection earlier in the game at least once or twice with Freeman picking up Hightower.
Yeah, it's standard. That's a very standard approach, especially with Hightower being up on the line of scrimmage as much as he is. He's generally the fifth guy. There are four down linemen that you're responsible for, plus a fifth guy. They set the mic. They do their calls. I mean, it's complicated to us, but it's basic to them. There was nothing more to it than Devontae Freeman had a mental lapse.
Well, let's go on. This was the problem I had with Matt Ryan in this one, and it's, you know, it's two plays after what would have been the play of the Super Bowl, which was the Ryan throw combined with the Julio Jones catch. Was just, I mean, it was just magnificent football. You know, they are first and 10 at the 22. They run on first down and lose a yard, so now they are second and 11 at the 23. And, you know, coming out of the Super Bowl Sunday night, I just couldn't stop thinking. I was losing sleep over this. You cannot take a sack there. Andy, what's the deal here?
I agree with you. That was not a great sack to take. It was not an atrocious play. It was not a horrendous quarterbacking play. It was just a poor quarterbacking play. And you can't take the sack given the situation, where you are in the field, how the game's going at that point. Having said that, Trey Flowers got relatively quick pressure on Alex Mack, and there was not Ryan had time to get to his second progression, and it was Mohamed Sanu who was covered very tightly. I think it was Logan Ryan had him on a shallow crossing route. And typically, I could see why a quarterback would not want to throw that. I think, given the game situation and the importance of not taking a sack, I think Ryan needs to throw that and make it a ball where it's either his guy or nobody, which it probably means nobody because there's tight coverage. So you could say that. Again, this is hindsight talking. This is the results looking. But I thought Ryan did get a little bit uncomfortable in the pocket there and reacted to the pressure a little earlier than he needed to. He'd also stayed on the Julio Jones read a little long. Julio Jones was his first read. So everything was just a tad off, and that's all it took. Now, the complicating factor of it is that read he stayed on to Julio a little long. It was actually another sail type of route, kind of a fade route, a deep vertical route. They had a dedicated double on Julio, and typically that coverage on that route, that tells you the play is dead. You should come off of that right away. Dedicated double means you got one-on-one somewhere else, and they had Julio completely out-leveraged. The complicating factor is it was almost the same thing on that 27-yard play you talked about two snaps earlier, which was as good of a quarterbacking play as you'll ever see. So only two snaps ago, Ryan had made the best play of his season, his MVP season, throwing to a dedicated double to Julio Jones. So I can understand why he would look to the dedicated double again. They're playing to win. They're playing to be aggressive. He's looking for the touchdown to Jones. I think he stayed on it a hair too long, and then I thought he came off of the next read a hair too early because he was a little bit concerned about Trey Flowers at that point, and he paid the price for it. Not an awful QB play, but awful, awful consequences.
And he's coming. Jones is running that sail route on the right side of the field, and Sanu is running right to left. So he's got to come all the way. He's got to look all the way across on that as well.
He does, and I wonder. And this is why we need to talk to. This would be a good thing to ask Matt LaFleur, who we're going to talk about later. Is Freeman, Devontae Freeman was in the flat on the side that Julio Jones was running to. So maybe Freeman's the next option there, and not Sanu. What I don't think that's the case. Freeman, he didn't have a great angle to throw that ball anyway. Yeah. That would have been too risky. But whatever it was, Ryan looked at Sanu at one point. That's where his eyes went. Now, whether they're supposed to go there or not, his eyes went there. And I think there was a tight enough, there was a tight window, but I think there was just enough of a window that he needed to get rid of the ball given the situation. But Gary, it wasn't like they didn't. New England did not have a blitz call on, so there's not a mental reason for Ryan beforehand to think I have to play faster here.
Yeah.
What happened was his guy got beat. So if this had been a blitz and Ryan had held the ball, that's one thing. But this was his center, his Pro Bowl center getting beat, and he didn't react great to it. And we're dissecting this in such small, minute detail now. If this were a regular season game and this is just any other moment,
yeah,
we'd probably say Ryan wasn't a great sack to take, but Mac got beat. That's probably how the play gets described.
And I'll just say one other thing about this play is, weirdly enough, I watched the coach's film today, but I watched the broadcast angle on this one more time. They had a replay, a very low angle replay, and it looked almost like when Flowers came through and beat Mac, he was just a tad off balance and just a tad turned the wrong way. And I wonder if Matt Ryan thought he could basically escape right on that play. But Flowers, I mean, look, he made a great play. He made a great athletic play and got the sack.
I agree with you. I think if Ryan were totally poised and utterly relaxed in that moment, he would have drifted to his left because that's where the pocket dictated he went. He went to his right. He's a right-handed guy. That's probably his reactive, instinctive move, and you tend to go to those when you're not totally comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wonder if he just had that reaction where he thought he could escape around Flowers to the right side, because it was look, you don't get pressure straight up the middle like that very often, and Flowers came in at sort of a strange angle and he was a little bit turned, and I kind of see what he might have seen there.
Well, and if he had escaped to the right side, for one, he'd done that on the 27 yarder as well, the two plays earlier. And for two, that would have changed the throwing angle to Freeman, and then he's got an easy dump off there. He didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't think he didn't have a chance to do that. It was, if he was thinking that, and I don't know if he was. We're guessing, but we're just talking here. That was an ill-advised decision there. Typically, Ryan in his most poised moment, again, he would slide to the left there. He's a pocket QB as well as he moves. He's a pocket QB. And he needed to move to his left. He didn't do it. It happens, and the results were bad. That Jake Matthews, the holding foul is still what put him out of field goal range, though.
Yes.
And that was a bad one. That was a very costly play.
And that's another thing. It's Jake Matthews, and we talked about this all week. You know, the Patriots, they don't have a guy on the edge who, you know, there's no Von Miller, Khalil Mack type of presence. There's no one even, you know, whoever you think is a mediocre, you know, like the 20th best pass rusher in the league. They have very ordinary guys on the edge, and for Matthews to get beat by Chris Long right there is, that's tough to swallow too.
Yep.
But, you know, like we said, so many things had to go wrong for this one to slip away, and, you know, if you just catch a break or two along the way, they hang on, and we're not talking about any of this, but, yeah. Those were, I guess those are two plays. The only other thing I'd bring up is, and I'd like to ask you about this, Andy. There were a series of plays in the second half during the comeback. I'll just say it was when it was 28-3 and on, where the Falcons snapped the ball very quickly. They were snapping it with 12 seconds of the play clock, 9 seconds of the play clock. This is when the clock is running, not, you know, after stoppages. After that Freeman catch, the Freeman catch and run, the 39-yarder, they snapped the ball with 20 seconds left on the play clock. And, I mean, I guess that's the balance. You know, you want to play tempo, and you want to keep the Patriots' defense on their heels a little bit, but, you know, boy, it would have been nice to slow it down a little bit.
Well, I think that's getting, in theory, yes, but if we're allowed to play hindsight, which I guess for the Super Bowl we're all allowed to do that.
We are.
New England finished with 2 timeouts still after that drive to tie the game. So they didn't wind up needing, the clock didn't really become a factor anyway. And
yep.
Atlanta has, let's remember, Atlanta has the NFL's best offense by a significant margin this year. And their thinking is, we're going to keep playing offense with our top offense. And let's just keep it that simple. What's wrong with that?
Yeah. No, I mean, this is what it comes down to for me. I put it more on Ryan for taking that sack than I put it on Shanahan. I mean, I'm sorry, Andy. I just, I am having trouble getting over the mental hurdle here. I know we're diving too deep and we're losing the forest for the trees here. But, you know, if you're Kyle Shanahan, you have the reigning MVP at quarterback. This isn't a game where – this isn't the 2000 Ravens where you have Trent Dilfer back there or you know, even a game where, you know, you have a young upcoming quarterback. You have an established veteran who was the NFL MVP this season. I think it's fine to put a certain amount of trust in him and to throw the ball in a second and long when you're at the 22. It didn't work out. And, you know, now you look back at it and say, should have taken a knee three times. Matt Bryant hits a 40-yarder. And then we, you know, everyone goes home and Arthur Blank dances. And it's bedlam in Atlanta.
Yeah, or you look back and you say, why did we take a knee when the Patriots still had all those timeouts left? I mean, keep in mind, the game was not as deep in the game as it felt. It was not; those were not the final minutes. It was about 4 minutes left. That's a lot different than under 2 minutes to go. New England had all its timeouts, two possession game. It's an 11-point game at that point. I think you keep playing football. I mean, I'm going to keep looking at the forest on this one. You play football. You have the best offense. It didn't work out that time.
I agree with that. I say you play football and you trust Matt Ryan. I think Matt Ryan just he tripped up at the worst possible moment, or what, again, in hindsight, ended up being the worst possible moment. But well, we know you're all still thirsty for Super Bowl stuff. I can't imagine this is the last time we'll be talking Super Bowl 51, since Andy and I will live for like another 50 years, and we'll probably have conversations about this game again. But if you want something immediately, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, he had Josh McDaniels right after this game. They talked for, it was something like 20, 25 minutes, and look, it was really good stuff. And for those of you who sent in more questions about John Lynch, guess who else Peter had on the Josh McDaniels show? John Lynch. John Lynch is the second guest on that show. That's how good the show was.
Yeah, Josh McDaniels right after the Super Bowl is great, because we're not talking about New England's offense right now.
We're
and that
not.
Offense, which is incredible, that offense was flawless down the stretch. Tom Brady was flawless. They dominated out of spread empty formations, which Atlanta had defended extremely well for the first half of the game. And something that surprised me watching the film, Gary, New England's longest play all game long, it came in the second quarter, late in the second quarter. It was James White on a 28-yard catch. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have any big-time explosive plays in this 25-point comeback. They methodically got back in the game just running their offense. Nothing fluky happened for that offense. I guess they did have the Edelman catch play, so that's, you'll call that fluky. But it's not like they had a 75-yard touchdown or something like that. Atlanta's defense did not blow this game. Atlanta's defense faced a better unit, and they were on the field for 99 snaps and 93 official plays against that mm-hmm. better unit. And eventually, the better unit won out. It was just the law of averages at some point.
Yeah. Well, let's get to some news around the league. Before we do it, by the way, Peter also had a live show down in Houston, and he did a very informal Q&A afterwards, which I don't think made it into the show. But first question of that informal Q&A was someone asked, "What's the deal with Andy Benoit?"
What's the deal with Andy Benoit? Now, you worded it to me the other day because I was awfully flattered when you told me this, and now I feel like taken aback.
You said,
where did he find Andy Benoit?
Where did you find Andy Benoit?
Well, that's very different than what's the deal with Andy Benoit.
Oh, it depends. It's I don't know. Maybe it was Seinfeld. Maybe he was setting up a series of jokes at your expense.
Oh,
if he
said,
what's the deal with Andy Benoit?
But you said, but that's not what he said. You said it was where he find Andy Benoit.
Where did you find Andy Benoit?
And I wonder what Peter said to that, by the way, because I
someone must have had the recording going. So if it's not on there, I didn't make it all the way through that episode yet. But
I don't need to hear it. I wonder where in my mind, because I knew of Peter when I was 6 years old. He was the Monday Night Halftime guy.
Yeah.
So every time I saw him, I knew exactly who he was, and I remembered it. That wasn't true in the other way, though. He had to keep remembering who I was. I had to reintroduce myself, felt like 8 or 12 times over the years. I would, hey, Peter, Andy Benoit. And he'd always remember the name, but not the face, and for a little while, as anybody would. So I just wonder, now that he knows me, where he thinks our relationship began.
That's actually a really good question. I want to hear the answer. I'm going to find the answer. I won't necessarily. I'll let you prey on it whether you want to hear it or not.
Well, my guess is when I was in college, I went to New York and I reached out to Peter. I emailed and said, "Hey, I'd like to meet you. Would you meet with me?" And he said yes, and we met at 30 Rock where he was doing his NBC mm-hmm. stuff. And I asked him if he remembered that a few years ago, and he said yes. So, which surprised me, but not really. I mean, I guess, of course, he'd remember that. We sat there for an hour together.
Yeah.
But I'd be curious if that's what he remembers. Like, ask him now and see if he says that's where he remembers from or if it's something else.
All right. I'm going to find out. Yeah. That live show was it was a lot of fun, though. Peter had Chris Berman and Mike Pereira. And it got the, on iTunes, it has a little E next to the episode, which means there was explicit language. So, you know, that was, nice. That was some
Who
fun.
Who was that?
I don't know. And if that's, you know, if that doesn't get you titillated, I don't know what will. And I don't know if we get a little E now next to our episode because I just said titillated. But,
if you abbreviate the word, but of the guests there, so it was John McClane, Peter King, Chris Berman, Mike Pereira, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Rank them 1 through 4. Who do you think's most likely to have used? Let's say the explicit is anything you can't say on NBC primetime.
Yeah.
So you know those 7 words or whatever they are. Who 1 through 4 do you think's most likely to say it? 1 being the most likely.
I kind of want to say Peter would be the most likely.
Yeah, I would
Peter
say
Peter does it, and it always amazes me about him. He's not sailor mouth, but he'll drop in a lot of curse words
if he needs to, in
our edit meeting. And then, but then if he's going on air, it's just gone. He's a pro.
I think, yeah, and I've met a lot of guys in the industry like that too. We probably don't want to name them all. It's amazing how many guys can turn off the foul language switch when they need to. I mean, it just blows my mind. I would say 1 is Peter. I'd say 2 is Berman. I bet I know he can be a little off the cuff. Mm-hmm. And all of this is in good fun. 3 is probably Pereira. He's got the most power. And McClane has the most to lose of those 4. Probably not McClane. Pereira's a powerful man.
I'll go with that. I've never heard Pereira off air or anything. So I
haven't either.
I wouldn't. I'd almost want to throw him as a wild card in between Peter and Berman right there because who knows?
The one thing, McClane, the one wild card with him is he's known Peter a long time. They met back in Cincinnati in the mid 80s. McClane emailed me to tell me about it. So when you're around someone you've known a long time, you have a different comfort level. So maybe McClane had nothing to lose in that conversation. Maybe he felt he could say whatever he wanted. He's just talking with his old longtime friend.
There you go. We'll find out who swore on that episode. But it's all there. Peter had a great week of shows, so check out the MMQB podcast with Peter King if you don't already, and if you weren't already, you're just not living your life right. But let's go. Andy and I, we're going to go around the league, and we're starting right there in Atlanta. Surprise replacement for Kyle Shanahan at offense coordinator. It's Steve Sarkisian, who... he had just gotten the Alabama OC job, and the Falcons pluck him. Matt LaFleur goes off to be Rams offense coordinator under Sean McVay out in L.A., but Sarkisian gets the Atlanta job. That was stunning.
Yeah, I didn't see that coming at all, and... He has – supposedly he runs a similar scheme as Shanahan. He'll continue a lot of what Shanahan does. And I've said all along, I think that's the important thing. Shanahan was the best offensive coordinator in the NFL this season, again, by a very wide margin. And so you want to continue with that. You want to continue with that approach. It's worked extremely well for everybody on that offense. And they clearly felt Sarkisian was the best to do that with. I would have guessed it would have been LaFleur, who's been under Shanahan for many years. But Atlanta, Dan Quinn, he knows LaFleur much better than I know him. Mm-hmm. And he felt different about it. Or he also knows Sarkisian better. And maybe it's that he really likes Sarkisian. Whatever it was, that's what they've done. And it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. Well, Sarkisian, for those who don't follow college football, he had been head coach at USC and Washington and was also a Pete Carroll assistant at USC. He runs he always ran a pro-style West Coast offense out there. So this is not a deal where you're bringing in some guy running one of those, you know, Mickey Mouse offenses of the college football world. And Chip Kelly, apparently. I don't know what he does now, because everyone linked him to this job, and maybe he just goes back. He might take the Alabama offense coordinator job now, which is a very good job. Pays very well, and
we'll see.
Plenty of success there.
Yeah, my guess is we haven't heard the last of Chip Kelly to the NFL talk. I mean, obviously, we haven't heard the last, but I think we haven't heard the last of legitimate talk. I think his name will be in consideration 1 or even 2 years from now still for NFL jobs. Not head coaching jobs, coordinating jobs.
Yeah, yep. Kyle Shanahan takes the San Francisco 49ers head coaching job. That is not a surprise. What might be slightly surprising is it looks like he is going to not hire an offensive coordinator. He will, you know, we thought he was going to do the play calling regardless, but kind of like Bill O'Brien did a couple years ago, he is going to not bring in an OC. He's going to do the whole thing himself.
Little surprising, just because with an OC, you can delegate stuff and just decrease your workload.
Yeah.
But he's used to being an OC. So his thinking probably is, that's what I'm great at. That's what got me the job. So I'm going to approach this job the same way. And I'll just add some stuff onto it. I'll learn challenges and game management and all that kind of stuff. Challenge flag things, that is. We'll see how it works. Other guys haven't done. Adam Gase is the best comparable to Shanahan, and Gase had Clyde Christensen as his OC last year in Miami, and Christensen's a longtime veteran who's been around some really good quarterbacks, Peyton Manning and Andrew Luck, for most of his career. So it's we'll see how it goes, and if it doesn't work out, Shanahan will find an OC, but he'll probably remain the play caller for a few years at least.
Yeah, yeah. The Green Bay Packers release a couple of familiar names, Sam Shields and James Starks. I guess we'll start with Shields because I said his name first, and alphabetically, by last name, he's also first. But, you know, he's not getting let go because they are so stacked in the secondary. He is he had the concussion problems, and you know, his future is very uncertain at this point. But they are a little bit desperate at cornerback right now if you're the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, they have. This is the first of many steps that I would think they would take this offseason. And Sam Shields, his cap number is a little too big to keep given his situation. And you wonder if he should keep playing. He missed this whole season with concussion issues. And he's had multiple concussions in the years before as well. Mm-hmm. He's a very good talent. He's only 29 years old, so he's right where he needs to be still. But they needed to move on, and it cleared $8.5 million in cap space. So this is not a surprise that he's not with them anymore.
Yeah. And then James Starks, of course, is out. He was injured and generally not effective last year when he was on the field. But, you know, that's another position. The Packers you have Ty Montgomery, and certainly you saw lots of good stuff from him last year. But Eddie Lacy is a free agent. You know, Christian Michael isn't really a guy who you're banking on as a you know, quality role player. But, yeah, they have to address running back, too.
And Michael, I believe, he's also a free agent.
So yeah, actually, they just signed him midseason, so he's a...
Yeah. And Starks did not have a big cap number, so this is just a team... He's 30 years old. He didn't play well down the stretch. I think he'll probably have trouble making a 53-man roster just because it's so easy to find young running backs, even undrafted rookie young running backs. So Starks, to me, if the running backs that tend to stay in the NFL in their 30s are ones with unique skill sets. Think like a Kevin Falk, for example.
Yeah.
Someone that, like a good receiving back or an excellent pass blocking back or something. I mean, Starks has not been in a lot of different systems, and he doesn't have any dynamic individual skills. He's just kind of a plug-in running back. He's had a solid career, but this very well could be the end of it for him, and this will not impact Green Bay's approach or anything. This doesn't change anything about this offense.
Yeah. Yeah. Josh McCown released by the Browns. McCown says he wants to keep playing. He's been one of those guys. I mean, everyone raves about him from a character and leadership standpoint, and he's been very popular with teams who have young quarterbacks and sort of want a mentor type of guy. He, I'm sure if he wants one, he also has a future in coaching.
the Browns must be comfortable with Kessler, Cody Kessler, as a backup potential then, as a long-term backup, long-term being 3 years anymore. But I don't think they'd get rid of McCown unless they felt they had a solid backup already in place. The issue, of course, is they're still looking for a starter.
Yes. Yeah, and they've been linked, Jimmy Garoppolo, Tyrod Taylor. Obviously, they hold two of the top 12 picks in the draft if they want to take one of those guys. But, Josh McCown is he's out there if anyone's looking for a high-character guy to mentor some of their young guys. And, Andy, let's wrap up. I would like you to join me once again in the clickbait zone. And this is related to the Jets hire Jeremy Bates as quarterbacks coach. And that's not the clickbaity part. The clickbaity part is Jeremy Bates last worked in the NFL in 2012 as the Bears quarterbacks coach. Apparently had a good relationship with Jay Cutler. Jay Cutler, look, there's stuff that goes on with Jay Cutler that we don't see. He has a very reasonable number for next year if the Bears want to hang on to him. All signs are that they will not. Jay Cutler to the Jets.
Why would you say all signs are not? His cap number is $16 million. That's a good rate for, as you just said, for a quarterback.
His cap number is very good. I'm citing reports coming out of Chicago that John Fox is sort of done with the whole Jay Cutler thing. I will as you fill time here, Andy. I will look up some specific reports.
Well, Jay Cutler has 4 years left on his deal, and they can pretty much get rid of him now with minimal cap damage. It'd be dead money of $2 million this year if they got rid of him. Next year, it's dead money of $1 million, and his cap hit's only $17 million. So pretty much very similar to this season. After that, he goes to $20 million. He'll be 35 years old. The year's 2019 at that point, so that's not likely. But that's far enough down the road that we don't need to worry about it right now. It's hard to evaluate Cutler without knowing what he's really like on the inside. I mean, like inside the building, also inside of his soul. His talent's very good. His mechanics become erratic at times, and that's not going to change at this point. He's mid 30-year-old veteran now. And do you want to play with that? That's the question. And if you're hearing reports that John Fox is done with them, then that doesn't strike me as ridiculous. But the Bears are going to have trouble finding. You're not going to find a more talented quarterback than Cutler.
Yes.
And
you're not going to find anyone close.
Not with what your options are. I mean, there are more talented QBs, but they're not available to you.
Yeah.
You're not getting Andrew Luck tomorrow. And if you do somehow were to find one, they're not going to cost you only $1 million a game. So they've got a good deal with a veteran. What is Cutler at this point? Is he like he's not a bridge guy because you're not bridging him to anybody. Is he a plug-in, fill-in guy? Maybe that's the problem. Maybe we don't even quite know what Jay Cutler is and how do we build our offense both here and long-term if we don't know exactly what he means to the team.
Yeah, I think he's entering that part of his career where maybe he's a bridge guy. And so specifically, Chicago Tribune, this is Mike Mulligan, said, sources close to Fox, said Fox said he was done with Jay Cutler. And Jason LaConfora, more recently, this was last week, said Bears are going to be moving on from Cutler.
There you go.
So those were the reports. I wasn't just pulling that. This wasn't a sauces type of deal.
I would, if I'm the Jets, I think I'd take Cutler if I can get him.
I think he's good. I think the Bears should be playing him next year. The Bear, and if we want to get really clickbaity here, the Bears have been linked to Jimmy Garoppolo because he has a shared alma mater with Ryan Pace, both the Eastern Illinois guys. So this is like Inception. We've gone to the clickbait zone within the clickbait zone. That's very exciting, Andy.
Yeah, no, I like it. That's good. That's good for us. I'm just thinking what the Jets. I need to be responsible because I don't want to get caught up, and I've probably done this over the years, getting caught up in the scintillating talent that Cutler has. because he's the fact of the matter is he's probably the 16th ranked QB in the NFL if you were to rank your top 32. He's an average NFL quarterback, but he's not average because he plays average. He achieves average by being up and down and coming out to average. Yeah. And do you really want that? Can you handle that? The Jets just had a guy like that in Ryan Fitzpatrick. The difference was I think Fitzpatrick has a lower bar of Fitzpatrick's
bad.
His floor is a worse version. Yeah, his floor is lower and his ceiling is lower as well. He's lower.
Yep.
So that's just what the Jets will have to figure out, and some of that might come down to how secure they feel about their jobs. The coaches, the GM, the front office, what do they think of their job security? And it's impossible to have Cutler and not have it be something political if you're bringing him in. There's got to be a political element.
No, and look, the Jets' options right now are Geno Smith is a free agent. Do you bring Geno Smith back? He just tore his ACL last year. When's he going to be ready to get back on the field? Fitzpatrick is gone. And then the other two guys, you have Bryce Petty, who, I mean, look, Bryce Petty wasn't ready last year. He might never be ready. And you have Christian Hackenberg, who no matter what anyone wants to say, and everyone wants to say, oh, could have taken Dak, they took Christian Hackenberg knowing he was a multi-year project.
Which means they're looking for a bridge guy then. So they need a bridge guy. So now maybe Cutler does become the bridge guy in theory.
Yeah,
if you want him to be that. That's the other question, though, is if the Bears, if we don't know what Cutler is to the Bears, we're not going to know what he is to the Jets either.
They should go get Josh McCown.
Who would you rather have as a bridge guy? Who would be the better bridge guy for the Jets? Cutler, who, if he's available, they probably get him for $12 million a year, I'm guessing. And McCown, if he's available, who they probably get for $4 million.
Well, and that's the other thing, is if you're the Jets, you say, we'll plug Cutler in and we'll be optimistic, we'll say we're going to get the best of Jay Cutler. How many games are you going to win next year? Is this, you know, everything broke right for them 2 years ago when they missed the playoffs. They had a good season, but they missed the playoffs with Ryan Fitzpatrick playing out of his mind. Can you top that? I don't know. I mean, I think they still might be an 8-8, 9-7 team with Cutler playing the best football he could possibly play.
Yeah, if they don't get better at cornerback, then that's true. They have some situations to figure out on that side of the ball in defense there. Yeah. I think I'd take McCown at $4 million.
Yeah. I don't think it's a bad idea. If we could just throw more conjecture out there with the Jets quarterback situation. But we'll find out. Free agency is right around the corner. This stuff will start falling into place.
Maybe not for the Josh McCowns of the world. Those guys, it might be till June until we figure out where they're going.
Oh, man. I'm having flashbacks of the whole Fitzpatrick Jets thing last year.
And I don't know if I could take another Josh McCown watch for a whole spring.
Yes.
The 10 Things Mailbag starts now.
All right, let's go on to the mailbag. It's a smallish mailbag, and it's smallish because everybody wrote in about the Super Bowl, if somehow you came into the show 40 minutes in, we did the Super Bowl up top. We hope we addressed all the questions. I think we did. But, the mailbag, by the way, is moving to Monday. It has been on Thursday, but since we are weaning off the Thursday show here, we're going to do it Monday from now on. It'll be the same thing. Send questions. Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. We are both on Facebook, very reachable there. And we're not both in that email account, but you can email talkback@themmqb.com and someone will forward it to us and we'll do it that way. But let's rip open the last Thursday mailbag for the time being before it once again moves to the Monday show. First one is coming from this is Twitter, at Harish3689. Overtime rules. This was another Super Bowl one that everyone wrote in about. Thoughts on OT rules. Wouldn't it be fairer if each team gets the ball at least once? I said yes. I always say yes. I think you have timed overtime in the regular season. I think you have untimed overtime in the playoffs, and you do it both sides go back and forth that way. Everyone has to play their special teams, their offense, and their defense to win the game.
I agree with that. I mean, we're not going to do the college overtime, which is
no,
just beyond stupid. It's an embarrassment.
Do not do the college overtime. Yes, that is a terrible idea, and no one should be advocating for that.
If each team gets one possession, you're going to see more tie games. You just are. And then we complain about tie games. So an untimed overtime in the postseason, I'm fine with that in theory. But then if that's how you do it, you'd have to make the postseason a different overtime structure than the regular season.
They did it in the past. When they first went to the field goal can't win it, they did a couple years of that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I might be with you on that. I'm fine with how it is now for the regular season, and I didn't have an issue with how it was in the Super Bowl either. It was New England marched down the whole field. Atlanta could have stopped them. They didn't stop them. But I understand the argument for it, and I don't think anybody now – we changed the overtime from the sudden death format a few years ago, and I don't think anybody has argued that that was a mistake in hindsight.
Yeah.
Hey, why don't we go back to sudden death? It was a much better overtime that they changed to, and it's not a full step that they changed it to. They kind of took a half measure with it. So maybe they need to complete the other half of the measure. I could be okay with that. But if you're going to do one possession for each team in the regular season, then your overtime needs to be 20 to 25 minutes long, not 15 minutes, because otherwise you run the risk of too many ties. Because these touchdown drives, those take 4 or 5 minutes each. So you leave yourself with very little time if each team scores. And unless people are fine with ties, but I don't think people would be fine with ties. I don't think they want that. And the issue with extending the overtime past 15 minutes gets into player safety.
Yes. No, I would be fine with ties in order to have the postseason overtime be where both teams have to play offense, defense, and special teams over the course. And it would be. And it would be more ties because you'd run out of time is the answer to that. But yeah, just not – no, the college overtime rules is not an option. It shouldn't be an option in college. But,
no, not even close. Not even remotely close. Why? Yeah, we don't need to get into that even more than we
have. Next question. You know, I'm a total liar. I said we covered all the Super Bowl stuff. Literally all these mailbag questions are Super Bowl questions. So we'll get into it.
That's what people want to go over then.
There you go. At Nicholas Borey, Hightower, Dante Hightower, of course, looks like the unsung hero of the Super Bowl. Forced fumble in Atlanta territory was huge. Andy, what did you see overall from Hightower? Because obviously that, you know, the strip sack was a monster play.
I think Dante Hightower, even if you remove the strip sack play, was the MVP on defense for New England in that game. Mm-hmm. I thought he was sensational in the second half, and mainly it was in setting the edge against the run. He played up on the line of scrimmage a lot, and he dominated up on the line of scrimmage a lot. He probably blew up 4 or 5 different plays, and that was just the plays he blew up. He was very solid throughout the game, and he was a movable chess piece for him within the context of their scheme at times. I am all for awarding Dante Hightower for his performance in that game, and someone's going to. He's a free agent right now.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Hightower, and they gotta carve out some money for Malcolm Butler as well.
And Hightower's a guy I think they need to bring back. We've talked about the Patriots. They don't do a lot of second contracts with guys. Hightower needs to be one of those guys that they do it for. He needs to be in that. He's in the Jason McCourty class for him now, or Devin McCourty, I mean.
Yeah. Logan Ryan. Logan Ryan was the guy we said maybe they let walk. It's nice when Tom Brady makes like $12 million a year, though. When you can pay him what someone's going to pay Josh McCown or
right, I was going to say, who would you rather have, McCown for $4 million, Cutler for $12 million, or Brady for $12 million? Yeah, I would too.
Oh, that contract's unreal.
Well, Brady has such an advantage because his wife is richer than he is, and I don't know what their financial setup is, but I have to believe that neither of them ever fears going broke in any conceivable way. So
her net worth is like $400 million or something. It's ridiculous
Play for free. He can afford to play for free. And I think the genius of it is if he gets – he's got 5 Super Bowls now. If he gets 6 or 7, which is totally realistic, then he probably makes more money in the long term than he would have in his salary anyway, because he becomes a permanent endorsement figure. And he probably is that already. But he's managed his endorsements so well. He's so famous that it's in his best interest financially to play to win at this point. And if he lowered his salary to $1 million to help New England get two or three more guys, that probably worked really well for him personally.
Yeah, I think the league has to step in at that point and say,
yeah, because otherwise you turn into the NBA. It becomes the NBA, and then you get fans like me who watched every single NBA playoff game last year and then felt like I got totally screwed over when they all joined up on the Golden State Warriors afterwards and said, oh, we're going to do it this way now.
Yep. This next one is from Kazu, big Falcons fan, via Facebook here. So our condolences go out to Kazu. But Desmond Trufant, fifth-year option, and they are expected to work a contract extension soon. After Trufant, you have Alford, Collins, and Poole all under a contract for at least 2 years. Who do you go with as your top three here? You know, when you're talking the four of them being healthy and going, and who might get squeezed out or who might get dealt or benched or whatever it might be?
I think they do what New England does, and it depends on who they're playing. Trufant plays the number one receiver every time, no matter what. Alford probably plays the number two, unless the number two is the size of Doriel Green Beckham or something like that, which in that case, then you probably play Jalen Collins on that guy, and Alford's your number three, and Brian Poole's the odd man out. But if you're facing like the Giants, where it's all a bunch of quick middle-tier sized receivers, six-foot guys and below, then I think it's Alford, it's Trufant, and it's Brian Poole in that game, and Collins gets squeezed out. It's a great situation to be in, though. They've got one more corner than they need. Or the other thing, Gary, and we didn't talk about this much. We talked about it on the Monday show. They played a ton of four-corner dime defense against New England. Olatoy and Goodson both played. They played almost 50% of the snaps together. They had not done that all season long. They'd played less than one snap of dime coverage per game on average coming into the Super Bowl, and they became a dime defense in the Super Bowl against New England. Maybe they want to go that route, and if they do, then all four of these guys will be playing.
Yeah. No, it's nice. I know you feel the same way about him. Robert Alford. I thought Robert Alford was no good. Robert Alford was excellent in the second half of the season and in the playoffs.
He got better in the playoffs. They used him like they used Trufant. He traveled with the true number one receiver throughout much of the playoffs, and he won a lot of those battles, including the one against Edelman. Alford had an out. He was one guy that, remember, we talked on Monday night, and I said I don't know if I'd give him the MVP because he was targeted a lot. Having gone back and watched the film now, if they'd won that game, he would have been legitimately in the discussion because he was very good. He won the battle versus Edelman.
Yeah. No, good for him. He had a really nice run here. Maybe he signed his deal a little too early. He probably could have gotten a lot more money at this point. Last question here. You'll like this one, Andy. This is from Eric at Emery 98. Hindsight is 2020, but with a tired D, should Atlanta have started the overtime with a surprise onside kick? I think that would have been incredible. I would have respected Dan Quinn forever if he had the testicular fortitude to do that.
He would have to really know his defense there. I don't think you do that. I think that takes
you
I wouldn't do it.
I mean, you can't do it because you don't recover an onside kick most of the time, and Tom Brady's on the other team. But if your defense was begging you, was saying we can't possibly stop them, Belichick might do it. Belichick can do it because Belichick would, he can sort of take the hit to his image, I guess. But
let's keep in mind, and I think Dan Quinn would be fine taking the hit to his image too. I don't know that, but I would imagine Dan Quinn didn't get to being a Super Bowl coach by thinking the opposite way of that, by worrying about his image and what's this going to mean. Let's keep in mind, New England on their final drive, they were backed up inside their own 10 or around their own 10-yard line. This is the game tying drive, final regulation drive. And Atlanta had them in third down and 10. And that was the play that Brady threw the out route to Hogan from the slot. It was the best play of the Super Bowl. It was an unbelievable anticipation throw against a cover three blitz, which Atlanta had done only one other time. So 99 snaps, two blitzes all game. That was one of them. And if Brady doesn't make that play, which is if he makes the play, but it's 1 inch off here or a millisecond later here, Atlanta would have stopped it. I mean, it was a perfect anticipation throw. So Atlanta had them on the ropes, so to speak, right there. And so that defense, yeah, they got marched down the field for several drives. They totally ran out of gas. But even in all of that, there was a point where they had New England backed up 3rd and 10 late in their own and back in their own territory, and they could have had them in 4th and 10.
Yeah,
I think you kick off there and bank on getting yourself in that position again. I think it's likelier that you stumble into one of those scenarios than it is that you'll recover the onside kick.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying, look, I'm not saying Dan Quinn can't take the heat or something, but I'm just saying, like, Daryl Bevel, who, you know, against a goal line defense with three wide, threw the ball, which is logically the correct thing to do, and you know, it was a 1 in 100 chance it was going to end in a turnover. You know, he's yep. Still, he'll forever be known for that. If Dan Quinn onside kicked at the beginning of overtime, Patriots recover, go 40 yards, and score the game-winning touchdown. I mean, that's, you know, you'd be the onside kick guy for the rest of your life.
And
unless you were Bill Belichick, in which case Belichick would just be Belichick.
Yeah, maybe. By the way, that Bevel thing, folks, Gary Grambling's 1% thing, that's true. That was proven. We went back and looked at goal line plays, and there's less than 1% were turnovers. And New England they had two extra bodies in run defense against Seattle on that play. They were playing a package they hadn't shown all season long, and Seattle did what you're supposed to do. They threw it. So I know it's old news now, but
yes,
you were so casual about it, I'm sure people are saying, hey, what the hell? But that was absolutely, and we could do, maybe that's a whole show right there. That I still say that Daryl Bevel play call was a very good play call. Not a great one, but a very good one with awful, awful results.
Yeah. No, I agree. Still can't go over Matt Ryan taking that sack on 2nd and 11, but yeah.
Well, maybe we need to talk about it for 10 more minutes. Maybe we need to go back over it.
No, we'll talk about it again in 2 years.
I don't think it'll be lasting that. I don't think it'll last that way.
I'll bring it back up. I'll make myself a note right now. I'll set an alarm on my phone saying, make sure to bring this up on the February 7th, 2019 show. But
all right.
Andy, that's a wrap for this one. Again, if you missed the announcement earlier in the show, we are condensing back to just the Monday show during the season. That will contain the mailbag, and we will look around the league and do that whole thing. It'll be lots of fun. It'll be great shows, and we might add a couple extra ones around free agency in the draft when it seems like the news cycle warrants that. But for now, we'll be back Monday. Thank you to Matt Havia, our producer, and Chris Basil, our editor, all the guys at Digital Media who make us sound really good, and Jeff Irwin, of course, our researcher, for making us sound like we know what we're talking about. Most of all, thank you to all you guys out there all season for listening to the show. Again, we'll be back Monday, so this is not goodbye, but thank you so much. Send those mailbag questions, Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI, both on Facebook, or send to talkback@themqb.com. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.